It's a big treat to us after being so long on seal meat. James found it surprisingly good and tasty. Worsley said that the piece of grass he ate has a better flavour than the sea leopard, and Hurley went so far as to say it was exquisitely tender and flavorous, especially Nelson, which equaled veal. Throughout the morning the swell had continued, and even increased slightly, so at lunch Shackleton announced that they would immediately go on a watch-and-watch system, 4 hours on and 4 hours off. Shackleton would take charge of one watch and Wild the other. Thus half the party would be on duty at all times, fully dressed, with their gear lashed and ready to move at a moment's notice. Two of the men on watch would be required to walk the floe continuously, looking for cracks or any other threatened emergency. The others would be permitted to stand by in their tents. During the day, there were more and more signs of an imminent opening. Cape pigeons and terns could be seen overhead, and Worsley sighted a magnificent giant petrel, snow-white except for two bands of black across its wings, a definite sign of open water. Clark spied a jellyfish in the crack between two floes and stated flatly that such creatures were found only in the vicinity of ice-free seas. These, plus a black water sky to the northwest, the presence of the swell, and a high temperature of 34 degrees, led Worsley to remark, "It certainly looks promising." But then he added, "Hope tells a flattering tale." Toward 3 p.m., the weather turned showery, and by 8 o'clock, when Wild's watch took over, it was raining steadily. Wild and McElroy moved into number 5 tent for the period of the watch, and in spite of the miserably crowded, wet conditions, there was a cozy atmosphere. Everyone delighted in listening to some new stories instead of the oft-repeated tales from the same wearisome tentmates. Soon after the arrival of the newcomers, the men were permitted the luxury of a match. "Are you ready?" Wild asked, as the smokers waited with their pipes and cigarettes. Then the precious match was struck, casting its glare on the circle of bearded faces. Individual tapers of tarry rope yarn were lighted from the match. Then everyone settled back, puffing contentedly. Wild launched into a series of stories about his past escapades involving ladies, and McElroy lived up to his reputation as the most cosmopolitan member of the expedition by explaining to an attentive audience his recipe for mixing several cocktails, including one guaranteed aphrodisiac called the Bosom Caresser. Otherwise, the night passed uneventfully. By dawn, the rain had ceased, and the wind had shifted to the south, blowing cold and dry. The swell gradually subsided. In spite of all the encouraging signs, the pack showed little change throughout the day and into the next morning. In the afternoon, a very dark water sky appeared from the southwest, stretching all the way around to the northeast. But in view of the southerly wind, a sudden opening seemed unlikely, so Shackleton deemed it safe to cancel the sea watches. But one-man patrols were continued, day and night. That evening, just at 8 o'clock, as Macklin was relieving Ord Lees on watch outside, the floe unexpectedly rose to a swell and cracked, hardly 2 feet from Wild's tent. Macklin and Ord Lees both spread the alarm. But everybody had turned in, confident that there would be no breakup, and the emergency caught them almost totally unprepared. There was a great scramble to get dressed in the pitch-black tents, with everyone trying to find the right clothes and attempting to get into boots that had frozen in the 20-degree cold. Even after the men were out of their tents, there was confusion about exactly what was the trouble and where the danger was. They groped their way around in the dark, bumping into one another and stumbling into unseen holes in the ice. But order was finally restored. The boats were moved closer to the tents, and the stock of meat, which again had been cut off by a crack, was pitched across in the darkness. Shackleton ordered sea watches resumed, and that the off-duty men turn in all standing, fully dressed, including mittens and helmets. It was hard to sleep. Throughout the night, the floe lifted very noticeably to the heavy swell, perhaps a foot or more, and the repeated shocks as it bumped against other floes were disconcerting. They all knew that the floe was now so small that should it crack again, something, or somebody, would almost inevitably fall through and probably be crushed. But when morning came, the southerly wind dropped, and during the forenoon the swell disappeared. At noon, for the first time in 6 days, Worsley obtained a sight. It put their position at 62 degrees 33 minutes south, 53 degrees 37 minutes west. They had drifted an astonishing 28 miles north in 6 days, and this in spite of 5 days of adverse northerly winds. The pack was obviously under the influence of a northerly current. It was April the 3rd, McLeod's 49th birthday. The party had just toasted his health at lunch when a sea leopard's head appeared at the edge of the floe. McLeod, who was a small but stocky man, went over and stood flapping his arms to imitate a penguin. The sea leopard apparently was convinced, for he sprang out of the water at McLeod, who turned and dashed for safety. The sea leopard humped forward once or twice, then stopped, apparently to take stock of the other strange creatures on the floe. The delay was fatal. Wilde had reached into his tent for his rifle. He took deliberate aim and fired, and another 1,000 pounds of meat was added to the larder. Thus the store of provisions was growing steadily. As it did, and their rations were increased, the morale of the whole party improved accordingly. The gloomy, morose grumblings of a few days before, when they had faced the prospects of eating putrid seal meat raw, vanished. And occasionally their attention even turned to matters outside the sphere of simple survival. The afternoon of McLeod's birthday, Worsley and Rickinson launched into a long, noisy argument on the seemingly remote subject of the relative cleanliness of New Zealand versus English dairy farms. Though everyone was fully aware that their situation was becoming more critical by the hour, it was much easier to face danger on a reasonably full stomach. Their floe, which had once measured a mile in diameter, was now less than 200 yards across. Most of the time, it was surrounded by open water, and it was constantly menaced by swells and collisions with other floes. Clarence Island lay 68 miles due north of them, and though they appeared to be making toward it, they were concerned with the gradual westerly set of their drift, which threatened to increase. If it did, they would be swept out to sea through Lopa Channel, the 80-mile-wide gulf between Elephant Island and King George Island.
"That would be hard," wrote McMeesh, "after drifting into those straits and then be blown out to sea."
And James noted, "A great air of expectancy everywhere. We're on the verge of something, there is no doubt. If all goes well, we may be on land very soon. Our chief need is an opening in the ice. Our chief danger, being carried beyond these islands in close pack. Our mark, Clarence and Elephant Islands." It was impossible to obtain the sight the following day, which was damp and misty, with an unpleasantly heavy swell running. However, on April the 5th, Worsley obtained a position, and it showed that they were headed straight for the open sea. Chapter 6. Somehow, in 2 days, their drift had veered to the west and carried them the incredible distance of 21 miles in 48 hours, in spite of headwinds. The whole party was stunned by the news. In the space of a minute, the entire pattern of their thinking had to be changed. The goal had been Clarence Island or Elephant Island, but no more. These were now out of the question. "This proves the existence of a strong current to the west," Hurley said, "and places Elephant Island beyond a hope of landing." Abruptly, their attention was refocused on King George Island to the west. "We now hope for east or northeast winds to take us well west before we get too far north," wrote James. "It is most remarkable how the outlook can change from a very favourable to a most unfavourable one in a couple of days. Conversation now either entirely fails or is purely concerned with winds and drifts." There were many who doubted that even strong easterly winds would drive the pack far enough to the west before they drifted out to sea, where the ice would unquestionably be dissipated, leaving them at best adrift in the boats exposed to the fury of the storms in the Drake Passage.
"God forbid we should get that," wrote Greenstreet, "for I doubt if we would survive."
That night, as they lay in their sleeping bags, they knew the pack was on the move by the ominous sounds of pressure all around. The next day was overcast, so that they were unable to obtain a position. But during the night of April the 6th, the sky cleared, and it was still fairly bright at daybreak. Away in the distance, almost due north, an enormous berg was sighted. But as the sun rose higher, they saw that the upper limits of the berg were shrouded in clouds. No berg was that high. It was an island. But which island? From their estimated drift to the northwest, many men thought it was Elephant Island. Others argued that it had to be Clarence. What puzzled them most was that they could see one and not the other, since the two should have been almost equidistant. The Clarence Island faction finally won out on the grounds that the 5,600-foot peaks there were fully 2,000 feet higher than any on Elephant Island, and would therefore be visible for a much greater distance. By breakfast time, the clouds had thickened, obscuring the land from sight. But at noon, Worsley obtained a sight which removed all doubt that what they had sighted was Clarence Island, 52 miles away. Even more important, the position showed that the westerly set of their drift had been arrested, and that they had gone 8 miles very nearly due north in the past 2 days. An enormous wave of relief passed through the party. "The upshot," wrote James, "is that Elephant and Clarence Group is still the objective, and as our present wind is southwest, prospects are a little brighter for the time. The ice got a little closer during the night, and the pack is simply swarming with life. We hear and see whales blowing all around absolutely continuously at times. A particularly ugly killer poked his head up and had a look around our floe. Penguins are croaking, and occasionally a shoal of them swim through a pool with a peculiar leaping movement, like great fleas hopping along the water surface and looking fine in the brilliant sunlight. About 20 seals were visible this morning at one time. Crowds of snow petrels are on the wing, with occasional giant petrels and skua gulls." Still, the damnable pack would not open. "Pray God we may find a landing here," wrote Macklin, "and so be off this drifting, uncontrollable pack, taking us we know not where, and in spite of any efforts we may attempt to make. But we are in the hands of a higher power, and puny mortals that we are can do nothing to help ourselves against these colossal forces of nature. If we fail to make a landing, and it is quite likely, I think it might be a good plan to make an effort to get on a berg. Indeed, many of us have talked and wished for this for many weeks now, but of course there are other more weighty opinions." Those opinions belonged to Ernest Shackleton. He was dead set against moving onto a berg unless it became unavoidable. He knew that bergs, though they looked substantial, could become off balance because of one portion melting faster than another, and might suddenly and unpredictably upend. Throughout the night, the hoarse croaking of the penguins, punctuated by the explosive sounds of schools of whales blowing, created almost a din. When dawn finally came, the weather was clear and bright, with a moderate westerly wind blowing. Once again, the men could see Clarence Island, and to the left of it, very faintly, the chain of peaks on Elephant Island. Worsley counted 10 of them. But the bearing of Clarence Island had altered considerably since the previous evening. It was now almost due north, indicating that they had gone to the east. Worsley's sight at noon confirmed the fact. During the past 24 hours, they had scarcely gone north at all, 2 miles at most. Instead, they had covered 16 miles to the east. It was almost unbelievable. The pack had done a complete about-face. 2 days before, they had been shocked to learn that they were drifting west. Now they were confronted with the fact that they were travelling rapidly to the east, away from all land. "If the wind doesn't change round to the east," Greenstreet said, "we shall miss the island altogether." There was also a dangerously heavy swell running from the northwest, rolling through the pack like low-moving hills of water, which lifted their flow almost 3 feet at times. Ord Lees actually became seasick. The easterly movement of the pack could be seen against the slower-moving bergs. The ice now had been reduced to such small pieces that it flowed around any obstacle in its path like syrup. That evening, about 6:45, McNeish was writing his diary.